Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. And happy 4th of July. I'm Neil Stavem. Glad to have you tuned in. Hope you're having a wonderful day. Ted, happy 4th of July to you.
To you as well. It's one of my favorite holidays.
Is it really?
Memories of the 4th, just being with family and having fun, relaxing.
Well, we're going to, today, while you're having fun with family, we're going to do a little history lesson, get some lessons on liberty, because, you know, if you're like me, you didn't really probably pay attention as much as you should have when it comes to some of the important history of our founding fathers. And we've got a great show for you today, and we'll introduce our guests in just a moment. Should mention, too, speaking of freedom, though, we're just launching a Live Free special promotion that just started here the first of the month.
Yeah, you know, the sad reality is that slavery is still a real issue in the world, and it's happening right here in America in our own backyard. It's a wonderful opportunity for you to help us put an end to slavery. Full details are up at myfaithradio.com for the Live Free campaign.
And it's an opportunity for you to get fit as well.
Yeah.
So check it out, myfaithradio.com, myfaithradio.com. Well, coming up in the second half of today's show, we're going to learn some lessons on liberty with Peter Lilbeck, who has written a wonderful little primer for young patriots and patriots of any age. But first, we're going to spend some time learning about valiant ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the fate of the American Revolution. That's the title of a new book just out from Nathaniel Philbrick. Nathaniel's an award-winning, best-selling author, historian, journalist, and research fellow. He's written 10 great books, and this one shows about some of the real challenges in the midst of the Revolutionary War. Nathaniel, welcome to Connecting Faith. So glad to have you on with us today.
It's great to be with you.
You know, as I've read your account of the war years, and I've not read Bunker Hill, but I'm looking forward to that as well, it pointed out, it seemed to me, how tenuous the outcome of the Revolutionary War really was. Did you have any idea before you began your research about how, you know, how much hung in the balance as the battles went?
Well, you know, not really. I think, like most people, I had grown up thinking of the Revolution as each battle as kind of a stepping stone towards guaranteed victory. And, you know, but once you get into researching the Revolution and discover that it wasn't anything like that at all, I think we have a tendency to look at the past, particularly when it comes to the Founding Fathers, as a simpler time when people were, you know, knew what they wanted, went about to achieve it, and we are now living in the society they created. But the fact of the matter is they really didn't know where it was going. And you know, written out of that scenario is the indeterminacy. They were making it up as they went along, and their motivations were partly self-interest, partly altruistic, and it was a very turbulent time. And so, you know, it's very easy with hindsight to see it all as destined, you know, to see it as truly God-ordained from the beginning. But that's not how it felt like at the time. Someone like Washington had no clue it was ultimately going to end up a victory, and we were going to be an independent country. I mean, even the title of the war, the American War of Independence, you know, assumes something that was definitely in the balance for those 8 long years of war.
I was interested, too, just maybe what factors determined whether a patriot decides to fight for the colonies or keep ties with Britain, because it seems like there was, you know, there were pretty close quarters and kind of intermingling, and, you know, that it wasn't a sort of foregone conclusion, I guess, that if you were living in the colonies that you were fighting with George and the militia.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what's interesting is that, you know, it's not even a majority of the Americans, people, were really with the Revolution in the beginning. You know, the fact of the matter is the America was the freest, most prosperous society on earth prior to the American Revolution. And most Americans were very happy with how it was going. And you know, the things would a revolution would break out in New England, and it ultimately would spread, and in many ways, Great Britain was its own worst enemy by responding with such unrelenting fury that it drove many Americans from being on the fence into the Patriot side. And so, you know, what you see is you see fathers and sons disagreeing on this. You see families torn apart by it. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, I think I grew up with thinking the Patriots were good, the Loyalists and British were evil. And you know, it was the militiamen who rallied together and threw off the shackles of British tyranny. And it was not that clear at all in the beginning.
Well, kind of at the heart of the book, Valiant Ambition, suggests that, you know, there was a lot of factors going on in terms of not just the relationship between George Washington and Benedict Arnold, but that there was as much concern that the battles would be lost from within as opposed to without. Right? Say more about that.
Yeah. Well, kind of written out of I think most of our sense of what the Revolution was about is that there was really a war with two fronts. America was battling Great Britain, obviously, in the War of Independence, but there was also a civil war going on, and in which you see patriots and loyalists going at it with one another, showing much more enthusiasm for fighting former neighbors and friends than fighting the British. Around British-occupied New York, there were large swaths of territory in, for example, Westchester County, where neither American or British Army held sway, and instead packs of gangs. If they were loyalists, they called themselves cowboys. If they were patriots, they called themselves skinners, would battle it out, literally raping and pillaging former neighbors, forcing people to abandon their homes, and turning it into this vast wasteland that was known as the Neutral Ground, along the shoreline of New Jersey and Long Island, would be the same kind of thing known as the Whaleboat Wars, where refugees from Long Island, for example, who had fled to Connecticut, would pack themselves into whaleboats, descend upon their former neighbors at night, and lay waste to them. And so this was, you know, it was as much an internal struggle as it was a struggle against Great Britain, and so it made it a very desperate and despairing time in America.
Well, not only internal struggle, I guess, among the militia, but it seemed like there was an awful lot of infighting, particularly in terms of the leadership of the army, the militia, and the Continental Congress. I don't know. Maybe are there any lessons we can draw from that? I mean, is that how our military has run since the beginning? It seems seems a little petty at times.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, there's, and at any age, there are petty squabbles that go into it. You know, we have a tendency to think, well, if you're, a government or a military person, your highest priority is what's best for your country. And often, personalities get in the middle of that. We like to think that Washington had a free hand in conducting this revolution, but the fact of the matter is that the Continental Congress, many of those delegates, were deeply suspicious of not only Washington, but the fact of that he was in command of a standing army. And it was a legitimate concern, because in the past, just about every revolution in which a republic was the intended result had ended in the military co-opting the civil government. And so Washington, after he has this incredible victory at Trenton, finds that, you know, the Continental Congress is deeply suspicious of him. His own officers are at his lowest point, scheming behind his back. And I think the lesson in all that is that, you know, what distinguished Washington from just about anyone else in the American army was his ability to weather these kinds of problems. He had always had the long view, and he also had incredible patience. And so even though he was, you know, he had the British to contend with, but he had all these other issues, and he was able to somehow rise above.
Nothing probably ever comes good when Congress gets involved in the minutiae of the details, I guess. And it seems like they were certainly involved in the war effort in terms of, you know, who goes where and who gets appointed, who gets the troops, those kinds of things.
Right, and this ultimately led to Benedict Arnold becoming increasingly embittered. Arnold was, yes, he would ultimately be a traitor, but in the beginning, he was one of our best battlefield generals and someone greatly appreciated by Washington. And after a stunning performance at what's known as the Battle of Valcour Island on Lake Champlain, Arnold expected to become a major general. He was the highest-ranking brigadier general, and he had by far the best record. But the Continental Congress decided in a political move that each state should have two major generals. And since Arnold's home state already had two generals, he would be overlooked. And in fact, five brigadier generals ranking below him would be elevated past him. And, you know, he was like, what's going on here? And Washington had the same, you know, was just as upset about it. And, you know, you see once again that, you know, it was all sorts of different things were going on. It was not just a military struggle. America was at its very beginning trying to figure out how it was going to govern itself.
We're talking today with Nathaniel Philbrick. He's author of the new book called Valiant Ambition. The subtitle is George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. He's written Mayflower and In the Heart of the Sea and a number of other fascinating books and recommended reading. And we're going to continue more in just a moment with Nathaniel so that we can learn a bit more about the great nation that we enjoy our freedoms today. Stand by. This is Connecting Faith. Listening to Connecting Faith, and we've connected today with Nathaniel Philbrick, who is a writer, a novelist, a journalist, a historian. He's written a number of books, best-selling, award-winning books, In the Heart of the Sea, Mayflower, one of the ones that I read not too long ago, The Last Stand, about Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of Little Bighorn. But we're talking today about Valiant Ambition, because it looks at the life and the war battles of George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the fate of the American Revolution, and it was hanging in the balance at those times. And Nathaniel, you write a lot about George Washington, and you know we laud him as the father of our country, but it seems like in many ways he was kind of overmatched. Have we maybe missed some things about George Washington as a military leader?
Yeah, well, I think you know you do George Washington an injustice to insist that he could do no wrong because you really rob him of what I consider to be his most amazing characteristic, his ability to learn in the job under the most difficult circumstances a commander-in-chief has ever worked under. You know, here he was fighting one of the most powerful military armies on earth in a country that was basically dysfunctional, trying to figure out how to govern itself. 13 states that were much more interested in their own welfare than being a united nation. And, you know, here he is just trying to hold this all together. And it would, you know, come down to his first major battle would be the Battle of Long Island after the siege of Boston. And, you know, he had never led a large army in battle. No American in the American army had done that. And he would be completely outmatched by his British counterpart, William Howe, and suffer setback after setback that would ultimately lead to his retreat across New Jersey and finally settling on the Pennsylvania shore of the Delaware River. And, you know, this was at the lowest ebb. And part of his problem was that by nature, by temperament, he was highly aggressive when it came to military matters. He really wanted to fight the British on the battlefield, even though his army didn't have the munitions, the manpower to go against this professional force. And so in the beginning, particularly the Battle of Long Island and struggles that followed, he had a tendency to put his army in a position of unnecessary risk. And several times we almost lost it all. It's not for the fact that the British general William Howe showed a reluctance to deliver the knockout blow that could very easily have destroyed Washington's army. If not for that, you know, Washington could have lost it all that first year. And what's interesting for me and what I portray in Valiant Ambition is a process by which Washington realizes, you know, I may want to fight them on the battlefield, but the best thing for my country is not to do that, is to hang in there, to fight a war of attrition, to try to outlast them rather than win a victory on the battlefield. And, you know, and that's an amazing characteristic, to be able to go, okay, you know, I will want to do this, but I should do that. And there are very few people who have that capability.
Well, and there, it certainly didn't hurt that we knew the landscape, the topography, right? Because the invading army clearly was at a disadvantage in many, many times, it seems.
Right, and you could argue that the British, that the hardest thing for them to contend with was not the American army. That really wasn't the problem. It was the scale of America, the American wilderness. It was just they could take New York, they could take Philadelphia, but that the Continental Congress would just move to another place. There, it wasn't like a European country where if you took the capital city, you had the country. America was such a new country that there just wasn't the infrastructure. There wasn't something that you could take and then have the country. It was inevitably Washington's army and the American people would slip through their hands. And it became clear that if, you know, even if they did subdue every state, they would have to leave an army of occupation to keep the lid on. And there just weren't enough people in Great Britain, and particularly the British Army, to accomplish that. And so ultimately, it was the scale of America that I think defeated Great Britain.
Talking with Nathaniel Philbrick, he is author of the new book called Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. And one of the characters that you share a bit about and you know, tell us more about, said made the comment about great men get great praise, little men nothing. Just maybe reflect on that and maybe some thoughts about what you were looking for as you were putting this historical account together.
Yeah, well, you know, the book does focus on Washington and Benedict Arnold, but there is another character, a character I came to really have great affection for, a 16-year-old kid from Connecticut named Joseph Plum Martin. And he's kind of like Forrest Gump. He would be with the Continental Army throughout almost the entire span of the Revolution. And he would be there at, you know, every important battle, it seems. And late in life, using notes he had clearly taken throughout the War of Independence, he would write his own account. And, you know, he is not a major general. He is just an ordinary person. And it is through his account that, you know, you learn of the incredible deprivations the ordinary Continental soldier had to suffer. The American people were very reluctant to pay the taxes required to fund the army, and so they just never had enough food, armaments, clothing. And, you know, and what's great about Joseph Plum Martin, he had a wonderful sense of humor, and he never he always cast a very cold eye upon his commanders, and so, you know, it's a side of the Revolution that is very different from when you focus on the great men, so to speak, of the American War of Independence. And so, for me, Joseph Plum Martin revealed that, you know, the importance of just the ordinary people, the soldiers that were there in the Continental Congress that kept it operational under circumstances that are very hard to contemplate today.
Ordinary people, you know, leadership that, you know, had many challenges. It does seem like, you know, the beginning of our country had a lot of providence behind it as well. That's something that comes
absolutely
through.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and ultimately, you know, it really you know, it wasn't a clear narrative towards victory, and towards the end of it, you know, after the great victory at Yorktown that would ultimately bring American independence, Washington, in writing to one of his generals, would just say, you know, you can't, basically he would say, and I'm clearly paraphrasing here, but, you know, you can't make this stuff up, you know, that, you know, just to see the succession of events that ultimately led to that victory, he said, you know, you have to affirm your faith in God, because how else could this have happened? Because, you know, he lived through it. He experienced it. And he realized that no time did it feel inevitable. You know, at no time did it feel as if, you know, he had the British where he wanted him. Not until the very last few days did it become possible to think that, hey, we might win this thing. And, you know, for Washington, who suffered through 8 years of this revolution, I mean, it would be 6 years that he would be away from his home at Mount Vernon. You know, for Washington, it was just amazing in retrospect to see how it had come to be, and ultimately was a great source of faith for him.
Nathaniel, as you celebrate Independence Day, and maybe for the rest of us, what comes to mind, I guess, to make this a meaningful time for you, and what might you recommend to us that we, obviously, reading the book is going to be very helpful, but how can we have a greater sense of awe, I guess, at the founding fathers and what they went through?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for me, there's definitely a sense of awe, and I think there should be a sense of humility. You know, it's what happened was not predetermined in any way that we could see, and it required people to, under the most difficult circumstances, to just keep on trying. And you know, because no one could see what fate had in store. And, you know, there is always a tendency, you know, it's a quite natural human tendency to despair and to give up. And I think the example of Washington, particularly when you contrast it with someone like Benedict Arnold, who finally ultimately did give up, and not only gave up but betrayed his country. With Washington, you just see how strength of character is ultimately has the final word. You know, it was, you know, not necessarily brilliance on the battlefield. It wasn't necessarily any one thing. It was just the fact that he showed up day after day and continued to do everything he could for a goal that he had kept ahead of him for 8 long years.
We've barely scratched the surface about Benedict Arnold, which, of course, is a key part of this book as well, but we don't have time. We'll reserve that for another, and just encourage people to pick up a copy of Valiant Ambition. It reads like a modern thriller, and you'll be challenged and grateful all over again, I think, on this Independence Day of the valiant ambition of our leaders and the fate of the American Revolution. Nathaniel Philbrick has done a great job in this new work, as all his other writings, and we're honored to have you with us today, Nathaniel. Blessings to you. Have a wonderful holiday. Thanks so much for carving out some time today.
Oh, well, it was great to talk to you, and I hope everybody has a great 4th of July.
Well, it's an amazing story, and one that we ought to review. And in fact, history is one of those things that we can easily forget. And so coming up in the next half of today's program, we're going to review some lessons from history, and lessons on liberty, particularly. Peter Lilback is the president of Westminster Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania, and we're going to learn about the Liberty Bell and about liberty and virtue and more in the moments ahead. I want to encourage you to stay tuned for this Independence Day edition of Connecting Faith. Thanks for tuning in to Connecting Faith, and once again, happy 4th of July to you. So glad to have you along. We're spending some time focusing on liberty and the celebration of the founding fathers and the providence that has been guiding our nation all these years. We're happy to have with us on the phone today Dr. Peter Lilback, who is the president of Westminster Theological Seminary, where he's also a professor of historical theology, and he is also president of the Providence Forum in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. He has an interest in church history, in Christianity as it relates to American history, and has authored several works. And one of them we'll touch on in a bit, George Washington's Sacred Fire. But there's another wonderful little resource that's something really designed for families, but something that You know, moms and dads and grandpas and grandmas can spend time talking their kids through. It's called Lessons on Liberty, a primer for young patriots. And with that, Peter, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Neil, it's a great joy to be with you and your listeners today.
Let's talk about Lessons on Liberty. What are there some key words that come to mind when we think of Lessons on Liberty? What do you think of first?
Well, the first thing you should know is that the book actually came out of a simple poem that kind of just jumped into my mind several years ago, where I was going through the alphabet. You know, that's a standard way to kind of think about something and say, well, what word starts the American vocabulary of liberty that begins with A? And so, well, the word America. And then how about B? Well, brave pilgrims. Well, how about C? The Constitution, and then how about D, the Declaration of Independence, and of course L is liberty. So all those sorts of words are important, but the book is designed by taking a key idea that goes right through the alphabet, and it gives you a chance to define it, to see examples of it, a historic flag in the founding of America that's connected with it, along with a Bible verse and maybe a great quote that comes from like Poor Richard's Almanac that gives a little flavor of the founding era. So it's a fun little approach designed especially for parents and grandparents to read with their kids. And when kids get a little bit older, they can work on their own, has projects at the end. But it was really intended to be an intergenerational, fun teaching tool to help families rediscover the liberties that have made America such a wonderful place to live in.
You mentioned Proverbs and Poor Richard's Almanac. You know that there are many quotes from both of those sources, and I'm assuming that those sources were very important in early education in our nation, weren't they?
Well, we know without doubt that the Bible was the foundational text of education in America. One of the best examples of that is that Congress, once it had broken away from England, one of its great concerns was, how do we get English Bibles for our people? That was one of their activities. And then we know that one of the signers of the Declaration, a man by the name of Benjamin Rush, wrote a very extensive letter explaining why the Bible had to be the core of American public education, where he goes through and explains why the Bible is necessary. And, of course, Thomas Jefferson, which everybody thinks is the person who wanted to have this very high and impregnable wall of separation between church and state, made it very clear that the Bible was absolutely necessary because of its ethical teachings for everyone. In fact, even as president, he made sure that the Bible was available to various groups such as Indian tribes and other people that did not have access to the scriptures. So it's hard to believe that today, but once upon a time, our country, including our founding fathers, believed that the Bible was the foundational tool for building the country they're working on. And that's why, even to this day, when a person takes an oath, guess where they put their hand and they make their oath? It's on the Bible.
You know, as the book suggests kind of at the outset, that we forget those lessons. We forget our history. Just, for example, about the importance of the Bible as a foundational instrument in our nation's upbringing. But, I mean, there are a lot of other lessons probably that we've forgotten as well that we should remember. Just maybe highlight one or two that particularly that would be appropriate for today.
Well, since we're thinking about the idea of our independence, one of the things that I think is really wonderful is to think about the Liberty Bell. The Liberty Bell rang out the Declaration of Independence when it was first publicly read, not on July 4th. That's when it was officially dated, but it was on July 8th. And when the bell rang out saying, assemble, we want to read something important, and the Declaration of Independence was read, the bell that rang that out actually had as at the top of it there in the State House of Pennsylvania, we now call it Independence Hall, a verse that says, proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof, Leviticus chapter 25, verse 10. It even has the Bible reference on it. And so I don't know that most people understand that the reason the Liberty Bell is called the Liberty Bell is that, first of all, it actually has a verse on proclaiming liberty on it that goes all the way back to when it was cast to celebrate the 50th anniversary of William Penn's Charter Privileges that established what we would call today our First Amendment liberties, the freedom of conscience. Penn established Philadelphia in Pennsylvania as a place where there would be freedom to worship God according to the dictates of our own conscience. Well, then it rang out liberty on July 8th, celebrating the July 4th Declaration of Independence. Well, after cracked and almost got thrown away, another group of people remembered it, and they brought it back out to symbolize their emphasis on liberty. And, of course, we know them today as the abolitionists. They remembered that on that old broken bell, it said, proclaim liberty throughout the land to all the inhabitants thereof. And they said, we need to end slavery in America. And so they actually gave to the Pennsylvania State House bell that had been cracked the popular name we know it by today of as the Liberty Bell. And so when we think about the Declaration of Independence and we think about the Liberty Bell ringing out freedom, we should remember it represents four different principles of liberty. One, the biblical Jubilee year, the 50th year from Leviticus 25, where we were to be freed from the bondage of debt and slavery. And then it actually has the idea of religious liberty, as we find it in the William Penn's charter when the bell was made. And then we have national liberty, which it celebrates on July 4th when we were freed and from our bondage to Britain during a time of tyranny. And then lastly, civil liberties, the freedom to be no longer abused because of your unique minority status in America. Now, that's a story that most people don't even know, but the most widely recognized symbol of America after the flag is probably the Liberty Bell. And yet it's biblically based, and it has a marvelous story. And I would suggest nobody could have predicted all of that, but what a providential thing that on that bell it has the word liberty that comes right from the Bible.
Appreciate that that good reminder and a lesson from history. We're talking lessons on liberty today with Dr. Peter Lilbach. Peter, the Declaration of Independence, as you said, you know, documented on the 4th of July, but I mean, it really represented an amazing experiment, didn't it?
It did indeed, in a number of ways. First of all, this was a moment in time where there had to be a theological, philosophical basis to justify an action that could be seen as rebellion and insurrection. How could you say to a king, you are no longer our king? And so the theology and the philosophy of the Declaration of Independence is the idea that a king is bound by a law higher than himself. There is a justice, a legal system that is heavenly in character, and that when a king violates that law, he breaks his relationship with his subjects, and they're no longer bound to him. They're not rebelling. In fact, they have a duty to protect their God-given rights. And so our American founders, in a marvelous way, said that we are not breaking a just bond with the king, but the king has broken his duties to God and to us, and we are now simply defending our God-given liberties. So that's a very powerful concept. Now, further in this wonderful founding document for America, there are four references to God. And they should never be forgotten, especially by people of faith, but all Americans should know it. It begins by telling us that we are talking about the laws of nature and of nature's God, that just like there's laws that Newton described in physics, so there's laws of God that we must remember, a king must remember, people must remember. We could say they're summarized in the Ten Commandments, often found on the courthouses all across early America. But then it says we're endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. Well, creation, God who has given everything its existence. He's the one that gave us the law, who gave us our life, our liberty, and our pursuit of happiness. And then it says, for the rectitude of our intentions, we appeal to the supreme judge of the world. In other words, they were saying, no, we're not rebels. No, we are not insurrectionists. We are not committing treason. We are actually saying we're appealing to God himself who gave us this liberty, and we're going to be judged by him. And we believe he's going to say to us, you did the right thing, because tyranny is not something that God honors. It is the rule of law and the rule of justice. And then fourthly, at the very end of the Declaration, there's those wonderful words that says, and for the protection of this Declaration, We appeal to divine providence, and therefore we mutually pledge to one another our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Providence is the belief that God is active in history, governing all things to his own end. Now, if you take those four statements and you put them together, they actually reflect the very thing that these men in that room at Independence Hall did would do about a decade or so later when they created the American Constitution. They were creators. They were creating a new nation. And they were concerned with laws. They were legislators. They were concerned with judges, the judiciary. And they were concerned with executive governance. And so they founded a three-branch system of government. In fact, those three branches of government are actually hinted at by the very way they look at God in the founding document of America. Again, the worldview, the theology, the philosophy that was at work in the founding document of our country reflects a very deep Judeo-Christian understanding of the rule of law, of God the Creator, and the source of justice in himself.
Getting such good insight today from Dr. Peter Lilbeck. Peter is president of Westminster Theological Seminary. He's also professor of historical theology and president of the Providence Forum, and has authored several works, including Proclaim Liberty, Broken Bell, Rings Freedom to the World, George Washington's Sacred Fire. We're going to talk a little bit about that. We've been referencing a wonderful resource called Lessons on Liberty. It's a primer for young patriots on this Independence Day, and there's more to come here in Connecting Faith. Stay tuned. Faith, and we are honored to connect today with Peter Lilbeck. Dr. Lilbeck is the president of Westminster Theological Seminary. He's also a professor of historical theology there and president of the Providence Forum, and talking about some important lessons on liberty. And one of the things that I know in just reading through the lessons on liberty, the idea of virtue seems to come up time and time again, particularly in the Poor Richard's Almanac. So talk about how the Founding Fathers understood how critical virtue is for this new democracy.
Well, what a wonderful question. The word virtue actually comes from the idea of something that has a strength. It is powerful. It is, and it has, therefore, an application to our character, and that our moral character is where our strength and integrity comes from as a nation. And this is especially important in the kind of government that our founders gave us. They gave us, if you will, a republican form of democracy. It means that there is freedom and there is a constitutional expression of how this freedom is to work. And they made it very clear that a republic cannot possibly survive unless the people that are under that constitutional republic are virtuous citizens. Because what does virtue do? It enables a person to have the strength of character to do self-government. It's fascinating that John Adams, our second president, he was vice president under George Washington, said in one of his speeches that our Constitution was made for religious and moral people. It's wholly inadequate for the governance of any other. And he said, we cannot have a police force or an army big enough to impose people's responsibility to do the right thing if they won't do it from their hearts. George Washington said, as he stepped down as the victorious general at the end of the Revolution, that if we want to have happiness as a nation, we must imitate the divine author of our blessed religion. He's basically saying, unless we imitate Christ, we're never going to be a happy nation. And he identified three qualities in Christ, he said, in his commitment to peace, his commitment to love. And what he was saying in the first point of peace is he's saying we can't be fighting each other all the time. Love means that we must be careful that we will respect the rights of others and we'll do what's good. And so imitating Christ was absolutely critical. And then finally, at the end of his career as president, he actually used this remarkable phrase that religion and morality are indispensable supports for our political prosperity. He was saying that underneath our Constitution, there are two pillars that hold up the floorboards of our Republican form of government. He said it's religion and moral behavior, and that's, he saw, as the source of virtue. In fact, one other example from Washington, when he was preparing to step into his role as the first president of the United States, he sat down to write out his thoughts on what he wanted to say to the first Congress, and he started pondering the question, what is the future of the American Constitution? Is it going to exist into the future? Will it last? And he says, our Constitution will become only a mound of parchment or a wall of words that can be easily jumped over by any politician who is filled with a lust for power and who is unchecked by a lazy electorate. Now, I don't know if that sounds like the evening news to you, but it makes me worry. But what he was saying is that if you want to have a Republican constitutional form of democracy, that is, people vote, but there are rules by which we are going to be governed, which are listed and required to be followed on paper, the people have to be willing to follow them. The political leaders have to be willing to follow them. And therefore, what we see is the need for a virtuous people. And so that is why the idea of training in the scriptures, the training in moral character and conduct was so important at the beginning of the nation, because it was not going to be a government by an all-powerful state. It wasn't going to be the anarchy of a pure democracy where you just vote and you do whatever the majority says. It was going to be the rule of law, laws that are enumerated, and that people then would have the character to say, we will follow what is right because this is what our governance requires of us. So you see, virtue was job number one to our founders.
Peter, I know you've spent at least 15 years doing extensive research on George Washington's life. You just shared a little bit about him, and you wrote that wonderful book, George Washington's Sacred Fire. Is there maybe one thing you would love for all of us to know about our first president?
Well, I really appreciate the fact that in a private letter that he wrote to one of his generals, he was looking now up at New York City, where you remember he nearly was destroyed, and by a miraculous fog that came in at the last minute at the Battle of Brooklyn, he was able to escape with his army. It's quite a remarkable story. He said, look at them now. They're penned in. They're losing their resources. They've been reduced to pickaxe and shovel. Obviously, they were protecting New York, and they were surrounded by American troops. And he said, the man that cannot see God's providence as this is more than wicked. He is worse than an infidel. Now, that's strong language. He's basically quoting the King James Bible there when he says that. We might translate it today, he's worse than a deist. I love that verse because it suggests when everybody says that he was a deist, I said, that's the one verse he could never have quoted, because an infidel in his day was a deist, an unbeliever in the scriptures. But the point after the end of this letter, he comes to it and says, well, I will add no more on the doctrine of providence, and I will wait till later to turn preacher. In other words, he said, I am preaching on providence, but I'll wait. I'll come back to that later. And you know when he came back to preach the doctrine of providence? Well, it was in his inaugural address as the first president of the United States Constitution. It's easily findable online. Just type in George Washington's first inaugural address, and you'll find it. And if you read it, you'll discover the first half of it is nothing less than a sermon on providence, on the fact that God was active in history. He says there's no nation that has a greater duty to give thanks to God than this new nation, the United States, because of God's many providential interpositions on behalf of the American cause. Quite a remarkable thought there. Now, the reason I love that is because if you remember the very ending of our Declaration of Independence that we remember on our July 4th weekend appeals to divine providence. For the protection of this declaration, we appealed to divine providence. And that's why they could pledge their lives and fortunes in sacred honor. And so the doctrine of providence, which is a biblical doctrine of God's action in history governing his purpose, is a foundational American truth. And it's on the basis of that, then, that we have our great motto that comes up now from the time of Abraham Lincoln, where it says we are one nation under God. In fact, that motto was the last act that Abraham Lincoln did to sign into law before he was assassinated. So every time you see that motto, when you see in the Congress building where it's carved in stone, or you see it on your coins or on a dollar bill, remember, that's reminding us of the very words at the end of the Declaration of Independence, that we are a people who've been blessed by providence. That was, in fact, George Washington's favorite doctrine. In my book, Sacred Fire, I think I counted over 270 times that he refers to providence, governing the things of life from the smallest things to the very biggest things. And when I counted that word providence, it was not referring to Providence, Rhode Island, the city. It's referring to the doctrine that God is active in history. And that's why he wasn't a deist. A deist says that God is an absentee landlord. He wound up the universe and he abandoned it to run on its own. But for Washington and our founders, they believed that God was active. And that's why they believed it was important to follow the teachings of the scripture for virtue, to recognize the truth of God's law, that is the higher law, even above the king, even above the American government. And it's when we remember that, that we have the basis to resist the ever-increasing encroachment of government, which we can call today statism. Because if you don't have God, government becomes God. And therefore, you become no longer one nation under God. You become simply one nation under government. And that government is not governed by the transcendent purity of God's justice. It's governing us by the fickleness of human whims and political power. And that's why knowing these truths, as Jesus says, also mentioned in the book here, Lessons on Liberty, shall know the truth shall set you free. Freedom comes ultimately by remembering we are a nation under God who's the source of liberty and law.
Peter, thank you so much for your time today. I'm wondering if, is there maybe an activity or a reading or something that you recommend that we might just do to give us a greater appreciation of our freedoms to do on this day?
Well, I would love to challenge every one of your listeners to do this, because it's probably been way too long since they've done it, is to just go online, download the Declaration of Independence, and read it out loud. It was once read out loud right here in Philadelphia, where I'm talking to you from, at Independence Hall, and they read it out loud from beginning to end, and they explained why we are a free nation. It's time we did it again. And as you go through there, even if you don't read it aloud, go through and mark those four references to God. See if you can find them. And see how they believe that if you have a tyrant in government, that resisting tyranny is not disobedience to God, but is actually defending the very God-given rights that we are created with as image bearers of God. So a great national homework assignment is to go back and read the Declaration of Independence, and I would urge everyone to do that.
Dr. Peter Lobach, president of Westminster Theological Seminary, and also professor of historical theology and president of the Providence Forum, has written several important works that we should consider, especially this season of the year. We've been talking primarily about a wonderful book for children, grandchildren, adults, and grandparents as well, called Lessons on Liberty. And they can find that. That's from Providence Forum Press, right?
They can, and I think they can also get it probably by going online at Amazon. You probably can order it there as well.
Peter, once again, thank you, and happy 4th of July.
Thank you, Neil, and God's blessings to you and to your listeners, and God bless America.
You've been listening to Connecting Faith. Thank you for listening.